This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's not rocket science. We know what to do, and as soon as there's this kind of will in society to do it, it can happen pretty quickly.
As Anne Frank wrote in her diary, hunger is not a problem, it's an obscenity. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to author Sharman Apt Russell about her book on childhood malnutrition entitled Within Our Grasp. We look at some of the areas around the globe plagued by hunger, learn how countries like Brazil and Vietnam have made strides in battling childhood malnutrition, and examine how healthcare professionals and food companies are changing the way they try to tackle this obscenity. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Sharman Apt Russell. Her new book is called Within Our Grasp. Sharman, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So the subtitle of your book, Within Our Grasp, is Childhood Malnutrition Worldwide and the Revolution Taking Place to End It. Let's focus first on the journey that you had of writing this book and how your perspective has changed over the last year with the pandemic and how that may have informed some of your philosophies about childhood malnutrition.
Yeah, absolutely. I started thinking about childhood malnutrition, frankly, when I was pregnant with my first child a long time ago. And I started writing about it. I wrote a book called Hunger and a Natural History in 2004. And that's when I met this doctor who was iconoclast and working on famine. And he was talking about this revolutionary way of treating severe childhood malnutrition. And he was talking about the new role of vitamins and minerals and the excitement of sending sick children home and treating them at home with this new therapeutic food. It was very exciting, and it went into the book then. And then that happened. In 2007, all the international organizations said, yes, this is the way we're going to treat children from now on. This is the revolution in terms of childhood malnutrition and how we understand it and how we're going to treat it and kind of the future, even to prevention, because we can give these ready-to-use therapeutic food to children before they become malnourished. So 15 years later, I was curious what Steve Collins had done with this revolutionary ideas of his and what had happened in the world of childhood malnutrition. What was the progress that had been happening since I had last visited the field?
So one of the lessons that Steve Collins kind of sets forth is that we need to discard what was not working, as you write, and specifically try to focus on feeding and helping as many people as possible. I mean, that sounds kind of obvious, but it's not.
It does sound obvious. Steve is a true iconoclast. He truly thinks out of the box, and he spent many years in the field working in famine areas. He's not an academic. So what he has seen for all his years in working in malnutrition, starting from the 1980s to now, is that we're not doing it fast enough. We're not using all the research that we learn in academics and then we don't apply it on the field. And we're bringing these kind of westernized concepts and concepts to people who are living with malnutrition. We should be listening more to them and we should be looking more at things that are working. And so, yes, more coverage. Instead of trying to do the best medical care for each child, really, we need to be reaching as many children as possible, not have this kind of specialized. So one of the great things, and this is common now, the international organizations do this now. Instead of having these feeding centers where you have doctors and nurses and IVs and this kind of standard medicine protocol, we send children home. We send children home to be cared for by their mothers and fathers with this, again, ready-to-use therapeutic food.
But that also means like losing a little bit of control in the process. And doctors want to, as you mentioned, they want a doctor.
Exactly. It does mean losing control. And to be fair, once people saw how effective that was, it became the norm. Doctors say, hey, we will lose control if this means more patients or surviving and we're doing more good in the world. What is too bad now is that the cost of ready-to-use therapeutic food is somewhat prohibitive. So we're still reaching less than 25% of the children who need this kind of food. And we've still really failed. So the book is about the revolution that happened, but it's also about the revolution that needs to happen now. And that in some ways, the pandemic might force happening. We're still reaching way too many, and we still need to do more work in the preventative area. Why, you know, not wait until children are sick, but get out those nutrients that they need earlier.
Yes, that's what made me kind of think of the pandemic when I was reading that chapter, was that the methodologies that epidemiologists and infectious disease experts are applying right now in trying to reach as many people as possible with COVID-19 vaccines, there's some overlap in terms of what works and what doesn't.
Yes, you know, lots of overlap. And also just that sense of highlighting that we're one world. These are all our children. What happens in other parts of the world does affect us. You know, we have to have this more united sense of public health and of responsibility for each other. So it's worked on that level. And I think it's worked on the level of just grab this opportunity. We're seeing that happen in the United States, and that's exciting. Grab the opportunity to end child hunger in the United States. Do it with a child, you know, tax credit. Do it with a national plan for affordable daycare. Do it with, you know, raising minimum wage. Do it with a sustained look at racism. So this holistic approach that says use all these interventions, we'll have a better society, we'll have a more economic, progressive society. So it's like seizing the opportunity that's coming out of a crisis. I think we could do this worldwide.
So tell us about some of the most glaring hotspots for childhood malnutrition around the globe. There are children hungry in every country, but where is the most urgent need right now globally in terms of countries?
Right, right. Well, there's a couple parts to that answer. Right now, of course, in areas of conflict like Yemen and Syria, parts of Nigeria, as families leave their homes, as there's disruption in society, then children are going hungry. So when you see images of skeletal children, of wasted children, you're probably seeing images from those war-torn areas. And hunger certainly increases in that time. But before that, hunger isn't really a direct result of conflict or of climate shock or of other kinds of social unrest in terms of most of the world. So before all that, unfortunately, India was an area where that there was a lot of childhood malnutrition, lots of Africa, in South America, a place like Guatemala. So you're right, it is all over the world. It's in peaceful countries as well as countries experiencing conflict. It's increased with global warming, it's increased with conflict, and it's certainly increased with disease such as the pandemic. But it was there before, too. It's nothing we can say, oh, this is just a recent phenomena.
Forget your weakness and dance. Cost of living gets so high. Rich and poor, they start to cry. Now the weak must get strong. They say, oh, what a tribulation. Them belly full, but we hungry. Hungry mob is a hungry mob. Rain or fall, but the dirt pretty tough. A part of your body you don't know. We're gonna chuck to jam music. Chucking. Hey, we're chucking to jam music. We're chucking.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Charmin Russell. Her new book is entitled Within Our Grasp. So, Charmin, you were talking about India as one of these places that has had devastating childhood hunger over the years, but it's also one of the success stories that you highlight in your book. Maybe you can expand.
Right. India is so large, and it has what they call states that, you know, as big as some countries. So in one of the states in India, they had an incredibly quick decrease in childhood stunting. So childhood stunting, I should say, is a particular kind of childhood malnutrition that has lifelong consequences. It happens usually in the first years of life, and it puts the child at risk for all kinds of problems as an adult, both cognitive and physical and emotional. So India has, over a third of its children are considered stunted. So when this state in India decided to do something about it, they used this holistic approach that we're all aware of. It's just a matter of implementing the tools and the knowledge that we already have. Nutrition counseling, sanitation, going from village to village, bringing vaccinations, particularly focusing on young adolescent girls, on pregnant women, and on children under the age of two. It's just a concerted effort that it's not rocket science. We know what to do, and as soon as there's this kind of will in society to do it, it can happen pretty quickly.
And it happened pretty quickly in Brazil as well, didn't it?
It did. It did. Brazil is another success story. They reduced stunting to the point that they hardly even measure it at this point. And it had a very high stunting and childhood malnutrition rate. So just to add to that list of things that a country can do, Brazil also focused on helping their smallholder farmers. They had school lunches that used that for everyone, that used local food and that thus supported the farmers. They reached out to rural clinics and they gave cash transfers. So they also worked directly with reducing poverty, and their cash transfers could only be picked up by women. And that's something we see again and again. If you don't empower the women in a society, then your effect on childhood malnutrition is really diminished.
Let's turn to the corporate side of your book a little bit. You give us some insight into how the science community and big business, big ag, big food, Nestle and Unilever, especially Nestle. When I was a child, Nestle was just, they were one of the most notorious companies for poor science, and there was a global boycott of Nestle products, and the way they dealt with their infant formulas was horrifying. It seems like they've learned quite a bit from that, but it's still a work in progress. Maybe you can kind of unpack the conclusions that a lot of us might just jump to when it comes to a Nestle.
And it's also worth adding, they're not doing great things when it comes to plastic use, like bottled water.
No. You know, I think I'll start with the idea of private enterprise. A lot of people in the world of childhood malnutrition and aid of fixing this problem are excited by the idea of private enterprise. And it's not about rich people giving to poor people. It's about prosperity. It's about decreasing poverty. And that means, starting businesses that deal with nutrition, starting businesses that deal with food within the country. And that means treating the poor as consumers and as active consumers who want good products, good nutritious food. So I think that generating business and this kind of social enterprise and exciting innovative products is wonderful. Now, corporations are kind of a different beast. They're complex. Nestle has had an evolution, and part of that has been accountability. When the Oxfam program started to look at all the brands and to hold them accountable for what they were doing, and then to make that very public, companies responded, and they changed what they were doing. Again, as you note, in some areas, they might change how they're dealing with marketing breastfeeding alternatives. So they might stop that because that can be quite damaging. But they might still have a bad environmental record in plastics. They definitely have a role to play. You know, we can't just ignore the major food and drink industries. We have to regulate them. We have to convince them that serving the poor, billions and billions of people, you know, who are consumers and who are potentially voters and who are part of our economic prosperity, that serving them is a good thing and to their benefit. So I would say it's probably the carrot and the stick. And it's also maybe having some faith that humans can evolve and can change and that they work in corporations too.
And do the boycotts from the 70s and 80s still kind of reverberate in Nestle's halls in terms of their policymaking today, in your opinion?
I think they reverberate, yes. And again, it's that accountability. When Oxfam names the brands and looks at Nestle's record right now, it says it has robust strategies for encouraging breastfeeding and for promoting baby food that's nutritious and appropriate. One of the best ways that we could reduce childhood malnutrition is to encourage exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months and continued breastfeeding after that with nutritious supplemental food. So child care, the child care of infants is crucial. It's key. It's everything, and to some extent. And Nestle is aware of that now and is apparently trying hard to do the right thing in that area.
And my memory may be hazy on this because I was a child, but I thought that one of the talking points that the Nestles of the world set forth for making the case that we needed nutritional supplements for children was that the parents were often malnourished. And so maybe you can kind of expand on the links between childhood malnutrition and parental malnutrition.
Right. Well, when we talk about childhood stunting, and again, that's a lifelong sentence of diminished potential in terms of cognitive and physical effects, that a third of it, we think, begins in the womb. In other words, if the mother is malnourished, that's going to affect the child. The connection between, for example, iron deficiency and neurological development is startling. Children who are deficient in the womb of iron have a, you know, less attention span. They have more anxiety. They have more irritability. They have, you know, learning disabilities. And we think the CDC estimates that 15% of American pregnant women and of American toddlers are iron deficient. So it's really a worldwide problem. So it begins in the womb, and of course it's going to begin with an adolescent girl or a young woman of reproductive age. So if she's malnourished, as a pregnant mother, and the other thing that surprised me, I guess, and saddened me is how exhausted women are around the world. In a lot of these poor countries, they do all the child care and maybe half the farm work and all the cooking. And they really are just, you know, in a state of constant, not only malnourishment, but just exhaustion. So there's a lot of work to do with that. Now, when Nestle says these are not the parents who are going to be able to afford a Nestle supplement. So that's a good idea to have fortified food for pregnant women and for children and for middle school children and for adolescents and for all of us. Not many of the poor are going to get it through buying something from Nestle, but the idea is good.
So these supplements are mostly being given on a very relief-oriented basis in emergency care type scenarios, or is it something else?
Well, when you mentioned that Nestle was promoting fortified food, I think that's very good. But I'm saying it's probably not going to reach the extreme poor because they can't afford to buy it.
Then I begun to get so low. Didn't have a friend, no place to go. If I ever get my hand on a dollar again, I'm gonna hold on to it till the eagle grins. I'll tell you why, because nobody wants you.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Sharman Russell. Her new book is entitled Within Our Grasp. So, Sharman, let's talk about the extreme poor in this country. And we have less overtly obvious childhood malnutrition issues here. Like, we're not seeing skeletal children on our TV in Florida or Oklahoma, right. But there is a tremendous amount of food insecurity. Anybody who volunteers or receives food bank food sees that there's tremendous need for healthy, nutritional food.
Right.
What are some of the lessons that you learned in studying some of the more dire areas of the globe that can be applied for better policies here in the U.S.?
Yeah, right. And I've worked in food pantries in America for the last 15 years, so I feel connected to the idea of food insecurity in America. Before the pandemic, 1 in 6 children lived in a household that was food insecure. Right now, where I live in a poor state like New Mexico with the pandemic, it's probably 1 in 3 children are at risk. And so these children don't always know when their next meal would be. And they go especially hungry over the weekend because they depend on school breakfast and school lunches. And they go especially hungry in the summer. And of course, they have been especially hungry lately because schools have been closed. And as I said before, we do have iron deficiency in the United States as a real recognizable problem. We probably have other vitamins and mineral deficiencies, although we're very good at fortifying food. But I think it comes back down to that idea of insecurity and the emotions attached to not always know when your next meal is going to be, to not feeling that the adults in your life are able to take care of you and that your society is not taking care of you. So I think there's this emotional and psychological effect. But mostly, and this is true all over the world, hunger in children leads to obesity or overweight as adults. And that's why the majority of obese children under the age of five, so we're talking about overweight and young children, the majority are actually in Africa and in Southern Asia and other parts of the world.
But you write that a third of us globally are malnourished.
A third of us are malnourished. The World Health Organization considers obesity and overweight as a form of malnutrition now. So when they say a third of the world is malnourished, they're including obesity and overweight. Mm-hmm. Here in America, that's probably our main form of malnourishment. Because, again, the effects of being overweight can be so serious in terms of when you're an adult, the effects that happen later. But the thing that some people have a hard time seeing is that being overweight is a part of being hungry. That you're kind of programmed physically as a child. If you're malnourished as a child, you're physically programmed to be overweight as an adult. And in America, if you're poor and you're food insecure, then one, you might tend to overcompensate. You don't always know when food is going to be there, so you might overcompensate. Or in America, you often live in what we call food deserts, where the most accessible food is that cheap, convenient, fast food. And you don't have access to kind of the healthy vegetables and nutritious food that lead to, you know, more normal weight.
And I think public understanding has really shifted over the last decade or so in this country about understanding this. It seems counterintuitive. I remember as a kid, you see in poor areas, you would see obese people and you would think, well, they're having no problem getting food, but it's exactly the opposite. They may not be having trouble amassing calories, but they're having trouble getting nourishment.
Right, right. And again, now in poor countries, there's what they call that double burden of undernutrition and overnutrition. Their rates are really rising of children that are overweight, as well as adults. And again, for some of those same reasons.
Maybe we can finish up with Vietnam. Tell us about the success stories that country has seen in terms of childhood malnourishment over the last several decades.
Well, yeah, Vietnam really decreased its childhood stunting very rapidly. It was in terrible shape at the end of the 20th century. I mean, something like 60% of the people were malnourished. I mean, after all that had happened, you know, to Vietnam during the 20th century. And then in the last 20-odd years, they really focused on that holistic approach. They encouraged women to breastfeed. They paid attention to childcare practices. They helped sustainable agriculture. They reached out to smallholder farmers. They improved some sanitation. So they also fortified some foods. And because they're Vietnam and have a very authoritarian government, they could also mandate things that other countries couldn't. So this kind of, again, this concerted effort, this holistic approach, reduced childhood stunting very quickly.
The book is called Within Our Grasp, Sharman Apt Russell. Sharman, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Oh, thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by The Crusaders, Bob Marley and the Wailers, and Van Morrison.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.